Do you mind? Some of us are nailing Catherine the Great here. Or should I say Catherine the So-So?
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 273 for the week of October 21st, 2019. I am Onion Dome, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Nesting Doll, Sarah D. Bunting.
Privet.
Drag Ball Champion, Tara Ariano.
D-seats across the board.
And self-hating German, Karen Geyer.
Scheiße.
Welcome to Extra Hot Grape for another week. Joining us for the very first time, you know her, you love her, you've heard her on Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. It's Karen Geyer. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
Yay! I'm not sure how many people who listen to Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean appreciate me, because I'm always like, what did you make me watch? What is this?
Oh, no, we're like that, too.
I think that's everyone on their podcast. But we are here not to talk about any Hallmark movie. We're here to talk about Catherine the Great, the new HBO import from Sky Atlantic, starring Helen Mirren. Brief plot summary. Catherine, the Russian queen, is not long into her reign, which will end up being 30 years long. She has overthrown her husband. There are still several would-be usurpers who say or possibly do have a claim to the throne. But she is, as of the first episode that's aired, is clinging on with both hands, white-knuckling it. We already know she has a reputation for being horny, which her son shades her for behind her back, though there is no reference to horse sex. And in the first episode, she has just met a new possible conquest named Potemkin, who is played by Jason Clarke. So let's go around with some general reactions, and maybe a way into this would be to ask, and we'll start with you, Karen, what does a period TV drama need to do at this moment for prestige TV to be compelling? And for you, was Catherine the Great compelling?
Yes. I think people have watched, you know, Game of Thrones alongside Downton Abbey and have certain expectations about period dramas now. The thing that people reacted to in Downton Abbey in the first season was the fact that, like, you find out in the first episode that the darling daughter of the family did it up the hoop. So that is something that you're not expecting to see or hear or whatever. And I think that that's really, you know, we know this story. This is like a particularly well-trod, you know, story that's been done. Like A&E did one with Catherine Zeta-Jones, I believe. So you have to, it can't just be about the horny queen in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I think really it has to have something that, you know, shows you something about the time that you're not expecting, or it has to give you some insight into the events as they relate to now. And that is where I think this really fell down, because in the first episode, there's some things that are sort of shoehorned in that are like winky references to Russia and winky references to like the Trump administration sort of. And I was like, oy, like, I do not, no, please. Like, I just want to see something interesting, and like that is an incredibly interesting time, and I don't need it, you know, to be about like Sister Hillary, I guess.
Right, right. Sarah, what did you think?
I didn't like this. I'll just not sugarcoat it. And you expect to like it because it's Mirren, and it's beautiful to look at. But I think that there is a way to locate you in a prestige history biopic project that you might not be well versed in before you came to it, that isn't quite so network TV movie.
Yeah.
And that's how this felt to me. I didn't get past the first episode because I just didn't care.
Yeah, like, we didn't either.
It just seemed to be a series of set pieces. Designed to explain to you who everyone is and their relationship, and you know, this is a reign that is contested, And then there's the obligatory, like, scheme fucking. It's like, I just, there is nothing new here.
Yeah.
There's nothing subtle about the storytelling. It's extremely predictable as far as where they place the plant feet, teach lesson, history beats.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know who this is for. And if it is for you, that's great. But I just wanted so much more from this while wanting so much less from this, if that makes any sense. It just felt very teachy and no thanks. The Crown, season one especially, was excellent at being like, here's where we are, here's when we are, and you're just going to have to catch up. That's what Google is for. That's what they should have done, and it didn't.
I didn't really have a problem following The Crown. I actually kind of felt like this first episode of Catherine the Great, it was felt like you know when you're a kid and your parents are having a grown-up party, and at some point you get called down or you sit there on the stairs and you're watching, and they get you and they sort of just throw you in the middle of everything. You really don't understand the dynamics of what's going on. You're not sure if you're supposed to be performing, and people are talking to you and you're like, I don't know you. And it's just like this general confusion, and you're just being like parachuted into the middle of it. Like, that's sort of how it starts. Like, they kind of start in a place where she's in power, things are happening, she's starting to feel the shadows creep in on her reign. But then, like, so many characters are introduced quickly, and it bops between where are they, St. Petersburg, I guess, and mm-hmm. wherever this prison is that one of the supposed heirs to the throne. There was moments where, like, they're bouncing back so much that I didn't realize that they were back at the prison in one scene until, like, people actually started running by bars. You know, like, it was just really kind of like at once very slow but piecemealy fast. Like, there was too many quick items rather than taking its time introducing you, because, like, Catherine the Great is a big historical figure, but not a really well-known historical figure here. You know, as much of Russian history is unknown here, I think you needed to take a little more time with her, and maybe even just a few screens of, you know, annoying text at the beginning would have helped too to situate her.
Yeah.
Like, there's no shame in a historical drama having a few, the year is this, so-and-so married this guy, and this guy is now dead.
Been fine.
Why is he dead? Because, well, she wanted power. I mean, that would have been fine, and I think there's no shame in that, and they didn't do it, and I felt like it was, as Sarah was saying, it was both, you know, too fast and too slow at the same time. She's absolutely right. Mm.
What I didn't get was, because they talk about it so much, like all of the dirty business that went down around the coup, basically, that deposed her husband, why would you not start the story there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, like, we're just coming off of Game of Thrones, all this, like, rah-rah Khaleesi shit. Why would we not want to see this woman take her husband down and have him clapped in irons? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I like, it sort of seemed like they were trying to hedge it with, like, well, I didn't have your husband killed, or your father, or whoever pig fucker from Black Mirror was saying. They were, like, trying to be cute about whether Peter had been killed intentionally, because officially they still, like, it's mysterious circumstances or whatever, but, like, I don't think anyone is going to come back from the 18th century and sue you for whatever you say happened here. Right. Like, I just seemed like that was the exciting story versus, like, oh, now here she is, like, just trying to beat away all of the people that are coming for her. Like, to me, that's much less interesting.
And am I the only one who thinks that the actor who plays Potemkin, all the actors in this except Kevin McNally, who I only know because I suffered through Turn Washington Spies. Everyone just looks like a ham wearing a tricorn.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell them apart.
Yep.
And I just don't care for him at all.
Oh, nope, boy.
Me neither.
There is only one thing bigger than the landmass of Russia, and that is Jason Clarke's head. Humongous. It's got a gravity well. And he nor nobody else in this production looks Russian at all. I realize the court is a lot not Russian, but it's also a lot of Russians in Russia as well. And we don't see any of them.
The one that took me out of it was Richard Roxburgh, because I'm a big fan of Rake. And mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was him at the beginning because I was sort of like chilling and watching it and whatever. And I wasn't paying attention to the face. And then at one point he gets mad and starts yelling. And I was like, that is Richard Roxburgh. Because, you know, it was something that sounded like Cleva Green. And so I was like, okay. I was like, that's Richard Roxburgh. And it took me right out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Jason Clarke for me is like, he's always going to be his guy from Zero Dark Thirty. So seeing him here in the wig, it was like, no. The only time that I thought he was a little bit likable was after he's gotten all fucked up and then there's going to be the drag ball and he's like worried that he's not going to look cute.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like that horse has sailed. He is my Joel Kinnaman.
Yeah. That's fair.
I mean, Joel Kinnaman is also my Joel Kinnaman, but in case I need another one, Jason Clarke.
Joel Kinnaman belongs to everybody in that regard.
Did any of you have a problem with like the actual like chemistry between him and Helen Mirren, which was non-existent? Like, I was like, why do these people love each other? Why do they like, why are they horny for each other?
Yeah, not at all. I did not buy it. And at one point when Grigori, who's the Richard Roxburgh guy, is like, oh, you have a crush on this boy, like, boy, he's like 50. Boy.
Like, yeah, really.
At least when you're watching something like, you know, Anna Karenina, like they throw you some eye candy. And here it's like, is this really the best you could do? Like, find a hot person who's his age. There are some.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't buy it.
Whenever I think of him, I remember that little bit in the Monty Python opening credits where the head zooms in on the screen, like it just comes right at you. Like every time he's on your TV, his head takes up the whole TV.
No, it's true. When they threw him out the window, it's like he's gonna cause an earthquake. Like his head.
He's like back. Remember that thing that they had in the Daily Mail a couple of years ago where it was like, this is what your body would have to look like if you were to like survive a head-on car crash?
Yes.
This is the most entertainment we got out of Catherine the Great,
exactly.
People.
100%.
Adjust your DVRs wisely.
I watched the whole series. And I like it for like the third and fourth segments. I had to watch them like more than once because I fell asleep.
Well, thank you for your dedication. Sorry that none of the rest of us...
No, I'm a completionist. That's the problem is I was like, maybe this gets better. Maybe they, like, you know, do something different. Maybe there's, like, some thumping conclusion. And there was not.
Mm. Well, that's a bummer.
It was a disappointment.
This was a fizzle for HBO. It was no Gentleman Jack. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, Catherine the Not Great. Bob.
All right, it's time. You know, once in a while, I just like shitting on something and just ending it early. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It is time for Around the Dial. First up, Tara Ariano.
Well, I have two, so I'll try to be, I will try to be brief with both. First was a Netflix premiere from this past weekend called Living with Yourself. This is the one with two Paul Rudds, or two Pauls Rudd, if you prefer.
I do. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. The plot summary is like, it's hard to get into it without really spoiling it. He plays this guy named Miles who's dissatisfied with his life, basically, like, you know, hates everything, not connecting with his wife, blah, blah, blah. A guy he works with gives him a tip on this spa that he can go to that will, like, turn things around for him. And he does. And then through methods, he discovers that there's another version of him, and the other version seems to be doing great and might want to displace him. Or, you know, both of them are not really sure at first what's going on. So... that's all I'll say. That won't spoil it. I never would have watched this whole thing. It's only 8 episodes, and they're like around a half hour each, if not for Paul Rudd, who is very winning. Like, there's probably one okay moment in each episode that's enough to, like, make you keep watching it. But when I got to the end, it was like, oh, that's where this was going? Damn. Like, it's... if you're partway through it and you're like, I'm kind of on the fence, like, don't watch it. This is absolutely a show that if it was week to week, you would for sure bail on it. We watched the first 4... back to back, and then Dave was like, oh, I'm good, and I probably should have stopped then too, but I didn't.
I believe I said, I'm good, this seems like the slowest episode of Black Mirror ever.
Totally. God. And that is very accurate. I mean, there's kind of a germ of an interesting idea here, which is, how do you tell the story of a person who has depression in kind of an interesting, compelling way? And it almost is, but I feel like this, like, just make a movie. Like, this shouldn't have been a show. And sometimes, like, because there's two Miles's, you're seeing scenes play out like twice and then three times. It's like, and here's what the other one was doing when this was going on. It's like, just get to it. Like, quit wasting my time. So living with yourself
has no payoff.
It's like
Green Bird counterpart.
Yeah, it's a worse counterpart for sure.
Oh, well, I mean, a lot of things are a worse counterpart.
True. Yeah, if you're interested in watching two versions of an actor you like, watch Counterpart for sure. Like, yeah. No question. Then there's Modern Love. Our friend Maureen Ryan, who, spoiler, will be on the podcast next week to talk about a different show, called it in her New York Times review the TV equivalent of an Instagrammable latte, which, yes, it's true. This is also a half-hour show. It's an anthology series that's adapted from the Modern Love column from the New York Times. And John Carney, who directed and wrote Sing Street, who I think is great, is behind this. And he's very talented, but he's not American. And that shows through in some geographically inaccurate idiom choices, which is like one of my irrational peeves. But like, Anne Hathaway's character did not ring up her ex-boyfriends. She just didn't. I mean, Anne Hathaway really might say that because she's pretentious, but her character wouldn't. And what I'd heard about this going in was that it's like it seemed like the same thing that people were saying about the Romanoffs, which was like, well, a couple of the episodes are good and the rest of them are not good. And that is true. I think it's generally agreed. Everyone likes the second episode, which is the one with Catherine Keener and Dev Patel. And I saw that reactions were mixed about the fourth episode, which is the one with Tina Fey and John Slattery, and that was written and directed by Sharon Horgan. That was my favorite of the season, other than the last one, which I thought was also very strong and almost till the end. But there's an episode, the third one, the Anne Hathaway one, is she's playing a character who has bipolar disorder, and she's sort of trying to explain how that works. And the framing device is that she's like writing this story as a dating profile, which is like, if you ever saw this on a dating website, you would never contact this person. Like, I get that they have to find a way to get these stories in that are like just chunks of exposition, you know, like the essays are in the newspaper. But like, this one turns into, you know, in when she's on her manic phase, she'll have like there's a, you know, a song and dance number, and it's like, you can't watch this and not think this is some white nonsense, because it is. But I will also say, I thought the first one made me think of you, Sarah, because it's all about a woman and her relationship with her doorman. She's a single woman, and right at the very beginning, she's like walking back to her place with this guy, and like she tries to get him to kiss her goodbye before they're like in view of the doorman, because she knows he's gonna see and like get in her business. And I just remember from when you lived in a doorman building, like, not that that would happen exactly, but that, like, you knew the doorman knew everyone's business because they were huge gossips. And, like, that was a factor of, you know, something you considered.
And I benefited from it. But, I mean, I also paid, because who was the one coming home at 4:20 in the morning?
Right.
That was this guy.
Right. Yeah. So I see what they were doing with this. There's like, it's really well cast. There's a lot of really lovely performances, even with some like questionable, very cliched material. But ultimately, if you want to watch an anthology show about people like living in New York City and all of the specific vicissitudes of how that goes, I would say watch High Maintenance instead, because this was not as good as that. Karen, you watched it too.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't connect with basically any of the stories. And it's funny that you mentioned the Sharon Horgan episode. Like, I'm starting to wonder if we need to send somebody to Sharon Horgan's house, because divorce is also like, I'm like, why do people watch this? This is deeply annoying. And it's like, it's so harsh and so cruel. And, you know, I know that, like, you know, with Pulling and, you know, her original stuff, you know, her character was cruel, but other people on those shows were kind.
Mm-hmm.
And Divorce is like, there are no winners on that one. And her episode of Modern Love, you're like, like, this is kind of a, it's kind of a one note bummer for me about like this like long term relationship. It's like, I don't know, like, that's what you have to look forward to? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem like it's solved where they just have one hard conversation where true things are said, and then it's like, oh, and then I get it now, and then it's 2 years later and everything's okay, and it's like, well, what were you doing in therapy if, like, if you weren't talking about exactly that thing that just came out over dinner?
Yeah.
So that's, I get that.
Like, that is sort of a peeve of mine about the entire series, is that, like, this is so everybody has rich people problems. Like, if you had to pay $200 an hour out of pocket and that was a lot of money to you, you would not be fucking around in therapy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. There's also the problem of, like, in the seventh episode, the magical unhomed person who knows things about the couple that she's going to place her baby with in adoption, where it's like, oh, she just needs to watch them having a conversation and then she can tell if they're going to stay in love. It's like, this is not good either. Like, she also does nice work with that role. Again, it's like, it's well acted. I think Olivia Cooke in that part is very good. This is the episode also with Andrew Scott, aka Hot Priest. But yeah, there's like, there's so much rough stuff to get to the nuggets of good stuff. Yeah. So like Mo, I cannot quite recommend this, but I will link to her review in the show notes because it was very good.
I find the problem with pop culture therapy generally is that when you see it, more often than not, it's only there so that the character can find their truth outside of therapy. So it's just like this red herring 80% of the time. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Also, don't ever fucking like spring Ed Sheeran on me without prior notice. Like, I don't need that in my life.
Agree.
It's in the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, for a good portrayal of therapy, and I'll just mention this again. I brought it up a few weeks ago, but couples therapy on Showtime is great. So watch High Maintenance and watch Couples Therapy, and don't watch this for my plug. On Again With This, our 90210 and Melrose Place podcast, we just reached our first goal of our Patreon. Woo! So thank you to everyone who gave.
Thanks,
and
guys.
So now if you are a listener of that podcast, if you choose to give us a little bit of extra money, you can get an extra episode once a month of Again With This, which we of course call Again With This. So the podcast you can find at, oh my God, I always forget the URL, againwiththis90210.com, and our Patreon is at patreon.com/againwiththis, and we will link both of those in the show notes. But thank you to all of those people who cross over with this podcast who were kind enough to kick in for that, because we're excited to make more stuff for you.
Yes. All right, Karen, it is your turn. What do you got?
Yeah, so I was ill a couple weeks ago. And
so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's the changing of the seasons. What can you do? Everybody sends their kids back to school and then you get sick. So I watched The Politician, which is, in the Ryan Murphy extended universe. And it's about this, like, really high-performing kid who, he was adopted by his mother, Gwyneth Paltrow, and his dad, Bob Balaban. And he has these, like, twin brothers that are, like, in their lives. It's not clear whether they've graduated university or they're still in university, but they're sort of always around. And the main character in the show is trying to become class president because he has a whole plan for himself to go to Harvard and then become the president of the United States. And it is very much, if you liked Nip Tuck, then you can see where this show is going sort of from the get-go. I actually think that Ryan Murphy is sort of at his best when he is writing these unapologetic characters in these ridiculous situations. So I really enjoyed it. It is a show that made me not care that Gwyneth Paltrow was on screen, because I generally dislike her. So
Wow, that's impressive. Good scene.
But she wasn't on it for too long. But she plays this sort of weird, Mother Teresa type mom who everybody falls in love with her all the time, and she falls in love with her horse instructor, and her horse instructor happens to be played by I'm gonna forget her name,
Martina Navratilova,
sorry. And so, which is a really funny note and like a really funny like gay history like sort of nod.
Sure.
And it's just what I love about it is that like everybody on this show is like queer in some way, and in like a wonderful way that hasn't been on TV before. There's also a subplot that is sort of a mirror image of the Dee Dee Blanchard story. So have you guys heard that on this show before? Yeah. So there's a character on the show who basically is a Gypsy Rose Blanchard type person. And the mother in that case, the Dee Dee Blanchard character, is played by Jessica Lange. And she does like an amazing job, because it's a weird camp role that's totally over the top. And she does what she does best. You know, she was spectacular on American Horror Story. I mean, and this is just an extension of her being great. And it's just one of those shows where, even though it's short in episodes, like every episode has something planted in it that pays off later, and it pays off beautifully, and everything comes to this like rollicking conclusion, but they leave things open for a second season in a way that's really interesting, that involves, among other people, Bette Midler. So it's just a wild ride. And I think that it got sort of panned in the reviews, like people kind of didn't get it. And I get why people might not get it, because you have to really kind of like the non-American Horror Story versions of Ryan Murphy shows. But I think it's interesting. I think it pays off well. And I like seeing representation. And I think that it's always good that, you know, he tries his best to represent people who have really diverse backgrounds.
This is the most enticing description of it that I've heard. So thank you. I will check it out.
So out of 5 Mary Cherries, how many Mary Cherries would you give it?
I would give it probably a 4. I'm going to be generous on this.
Wow. Okay.
I'm going to put on my light up dress and check it out.
Love it. All right. What would you like to plug?
Oh, so I have 2 podcasts. One is called On Belief, a podcast about cults. And that is at wherever you get podcasts. It's On Belief, a podcast about cults. And the Patreon for that is patreon.com/Karen Geyer. The other podcast that I have that just started is called On Grief, a podcast about death. And on that show, we talk with somebody who is close to the dead, the dying, or the grieving, and we talk about different episodes. So one episode, I did a near-death experience using the most powerful psychedelic on Earth to see what it's like to die. In another episode, we interviewed a mortician.
Wait, you took it?
Yeah.
Okay. And? I mean, you're still here.
Yes.
I mean, do you have any insights into the great beyond? Or, I mean, we'll listen to the podcast to find out, I guess.
Yes. Well, what's really interesting is on that same episode, I interviewed a neurosurgeon who had also had a near-death experience. And we sort of compared notes. And, you know, he had this very religious experience. I did not. I felt the going all the way black. And I felt like the going towards the light. And then I felt like a love bomb going off in my chest. But at no point did that have a spiritual or religious component to it for me. And, you know, everybody's different. I was open to that, if that was how it was going to present itself. But it didn't. So, but it was still like a profoundly moving experience. I woke up, I was crying. And we ran tape on the whole thing, and you can hear it. And I said I said to the person who gave it to me, I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for this gift. And I'm crying. Yeah. I highly do not recommend running tape when you take the most powerful psychedelic on Earth, but what can I say?
I'm writing that down.
So, you can find that anywhere that you get podcasts. That's called On Grief, a podcast about death.
We enjoyed that music cue after that whole death thing. Yeah. Sarah D. Vantik.
So, Survivor, this is a catch-up roundup of stuff that we have talked about on the show in recent episodes. I, like, binged the last few episodes of Survivor over the weekend. This is one of those seasons that's good. I committed to it, not knowing if it was going to continue to be good. But it's like, it's a blindside basically of someone every week. I'm not sure that they can sustain this. I hope they can, but also Giving Me Life is Rob and Sandra in their little like duck blind hut watching Tribal Council. It is amazing, just like that she will just be staring with the classic Sandra fuck out of here face, and Rob is like pulling all these what faces because they have to be quiet so that like sometimes they talk, but it's extremely quiet and has to be captioned. I would spend money on just the footage of them watching Tribal Council, no context. I don't need to see what happened to Tribal. I don't need any Chirons telling me what's going on. I just would watch their reactions. They're so funny. I wish that were a bigger part of the show. But the episodes as they are very good. And if you were sort of like, oh, interesting, I'll watch the premiere, and then you fell off of it, like just stack them up on the DVR and wait for a rainy day. It's good. Next up, Ken Burns Country Music. They dropped like 17 hours of hillbilly intel over 3 days or something like that. So it's taking me a while to catch up. I'm in like the early 60s somewhere. I think Patsy Cline just died, speaking of Jessica Lange. And it too is really good. But unfortunately, like Peter Coyote's narration now has that, that like Humphrey Bogart effect, which is why I had to watch The Maltese Falcon. Like I've seen it all the way through once, but I started it 17 times. It just has this like narcotic effect where he's like following Hank Williams. It's like 7 seconds on the little slider. And I'm like, ah, so it's taking a while, but it's really well done. They have the good visuals and everything. And if anyone else stuck with it or is trying to stick with it, but it's having to watch it in like 12 second chunks like I am, hit me on Twitter at Tomato Nation.
Before you move on, I just want to mention that the phrase hillbilly intel is not only A, delightful, but B, absolutely zero true hits on Google. So if you're looking for a unique SEO podcast title,
hey,
hillbilly intel is there for you. You just got to like slip Sarah a little dough.
Yeah, I mean, I can't use it. I'm from Jersey, so
this seems
I mean,
like something where it should be a podcast with like hillbilly life hacks.
Yes. Okay, Buzz.
Yes.
Remind people what Buzz was because I forgot.
Okay, Buzz is about Pulitzer Prize winner Buzz Bissinger, who wrote the book Friday Night Lights. He wrote some other stuff. He was famously in some like round table moderated by Bob Costas about steroids, where he was such a like abrasive pill. He's like David Simon but with zero charm.
Yeah,
like,
we should say that round table he was on with Will Leach and like laid into him. Yeah. This was when our friend Will, past and surely future guest of the show, was the editor, founding editor of Deadspin. And Buzz was just like super snotty about the internet. Like in general.
Yeah, like this homunculus, it was just an abrasive twat, and I have hated him ever since.
Yeah.
So I was really excited to dig into this, and it's an interesting prospect because I at least felt first guilty for hating him when it seemed clear that he needed embracing and encouragement in some of the things that he was struggling with. Mm-hmm. And then I resented that feeling of guilt because he's still an abrasive twat.
Yep.
Like he just, and then his like, I don't know what the movie thinks we think, but it's like, I would much rather watch like all the cut footage of his wife.
Yeah, it's funny in the end that like one of the framing devices is him writing Caitlyn Jenner's or collaborating on it on her memoir.
Yeah.
Because it's true of both of them where it's like, I honor and respect and see your, you know, identity journey. But at the same time, you have a lot of bad ideas and yeah, like we cannot really vibe because you're wrong about a lot.
Yeah, well, you absolutely have the right to live your authentic self, mm-hmm, but unfortunately, yourself is an asshole.
Yep.
Both of you. Like, be whatever, wherever on the identity spectrum you would mm-hmm. like to be. I don't want to know you personally, and yep. I won't. So Godspeed to you both. I will also
But you're
say,
not sorry you watched the movie.
Oh my God, no. No, no. Yeah. It was fascinating. I was not bored for a second, not least when he's shopping and it's like I could almost smell the leather in mm-hmm. that store. I was like, I think I want to go to there and
yeah.
perhaps buy a handbag. I don't need to be zipped into the handbag as part of my identity sex play. But anyway, if you were like, this is all too vague and I don't know, trust me, just watch it. If you can deal with Buzz as a person.
Yeah, it's on HBO Go.
He's a tough one. For my plug, you can come and discuss this with me personally at the Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs live event Thursday, Ooh. November 7th. You can buy tickets at mastass.eventbrite. That's BRITE.com. There's still a handful of tickets left. We will have a number of surprise, exciting visitors and guests from lands far away, like Georgia, not the Russian Georgia, like the state of Georgia, but that's pretty far to come for this. We'll be ranking songs with Hold On in the title, and We Need Your Help. It's at the Van Brunt Stillhouse. That's Thursday, November 7th, Mastass Live.
All right. I want to talk about the HBO series Watchmen. I know everybody listening to this, for the most part, has only watched one episode. So here is my review after one episode. What? Huh? yeah. I mean, I think I saw Dr. Manhattan. What? I don't know what the rest of this is. And then flash forward me getting to episode 3. Oh, okay. All right. And now here's me in episode 6. That was really good. So,
yeah.
There's a timeline review. I know you're only at episode 1. And if you had read The Watchmen, were a fan of the comic like I am, and you watched it and you were sort of underwhelmed or sidewhelmed or confused or just didn't get where the roadmap was taking you, that's fine, because I think that's natural. It doesn't really become what's on the tin until a little bit later in the series. You get the beats of it insofar that we have swapped a leeriness about people in masks in the Cold War for a leeriness in people in masks in, you know, the culture war, I guess. And that is sort of like where we start. But it doesn't really feel like Watchmen until episode 3. So if you're a fan of Watchmen and you're watching and you were sort of let down by it, stick with it, because it does pay dividends. And by the end of the episodes that we had provided by HBO, I was really into it. Tara watched with me and I think had a similar take, although I think she started from a place of like, you know, she had her arms crossed watching the first episode.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. We should specify, we didn't watch ahead, just like it's not on HBO Go. We got screeners. So we watched the first 6 screeners of the 9 episode season. So it's true that like the first episode is really not indicative of where it's going. Like it's setting a lot of stuff up that's not going to pay off until so much later. Like to wait until basically 2/3 of the way through your debut season to like kind of undo what was seemingly set up in the first episode is really asking so much of your audience. And like, I don't know if people who aren't like super duper Watchmen fans are going to get to the end of that and be like, yes, I want to see more of it. Cause it's not that the first episode is bad, but like my take on it at the end was like, its politics are completely incoherent. Right. Like it's, you know, we're not crazy to be concerned that Damon Lindelof might not be the person to tell the story of what makes policing a racist institution, like, or tease out the distinctions between the white supremacists who are not sanctioned by the state and the ones who are, aka cops. But, and even in that third episode where, you know, our heroine comes in, like, she says something like, you know, or are they violating your civil rights about cops? And then the person starts to answer and she's like, oh, I don't really care. Like there's a lot of, you know, shit like that where it's like, this is really iffy. But like, then it, you know, it takes a while to come around to where you understand what they're doing. But I honestly, like, I might not have stuck it out for all of those if not for James Poniewozik's review. So I will link to that in the show notes too, because it really, really reassured me. But like, yeah, there's a lot going on here. It's not all. Sometimes I feel like the Watchmen name is like a very, very loose framework that they've hung this kind of mostly unrelated story on. What do you think, Dave?
You know what? I think they did a pretty good job towards, or let's say in the last half of what we watched, so episode 3, 4, 5, 6, mostly 4, 5, 6, of really weaving in Watchmen storylines into what they were building in the first episode with the, mm-hmm. you know, the Tulsa Black Wall Street massacre. But the flip side of that is, I don't know how much you're going to get out of it if you haven't read Watchmen and really kind of know your Watchmen graphic novel, because they do try to kind of explain it, but like I feel like it's more of a reminder of what happened in the Watchmen. If you're like me, like I read Watchmen a couple of years ago the last time I read it, and that guy I get it now. But if I hadn't, I might be kind of confused by what's going on with sort of reintroducing Watchmen elements into the present day.
Mm-hmm.
If you find the whole universe compelling in any way, I think it behooves you to give Watchmen graphic novel a read so that you can get a deeper understanding, because there's this whole storyline with Jeremy Irons that hasn't weaved in yet, but obviously is going to be a big catalyst for future events in this universe. And if you've read the graphic novel, you've got a pretty good guess at who this dude is, and you're probably right, and you know that he's gonna mess stuff up and is really fun, interesting part of the story that hasn't integrated with the main thrust yet. So
yeah, his shit gets really weird and dark. But his storyline is Sarah's old friend Tom Mizen from Sleepy Hollow is back.
Oh, good.
I do want to ask the general audience this, and this is the genuine question. Is the first episode of Watchmen the first time we actually see a superhero apply their black eye makeup?
And it's very professional. She's got an airbrush and everything.
Yeah.
I'll just mention, too, because Karen brought up the politician, that there's a show within a show that's about the Minutemen, who are like the original Watchmen characters from the book. And it's made to look like really campy and corny. And so I said to Dave while we were watching it, in my headcanon, this show is produced by the Ryan Murphy of this universe, because it's called American Hero Story. And then at a certain point, someone gets unmasked, and it's someone who has been in multiple seasons of American Horror Story. So I won't say who, but I felt very gratified. Fine, it's Jessica Lange. Just kidding, it's not Jessica Lange.
Between the title and the subject matter of that show within a show, absolutely. I do want to throw this out there. If KFC is still doing those Colonel Sanders as a different actor every couple months thing, I think you can slot Don Johnson in there pretty easily now. Dude is Colonel Sanders now.
Sold.
And overall, I just really liked it. I figured out what my Watchmen name mask identity thing is, and it's Masker Dave, because nobody would suspect that I would put my own name in my Watchmen name. So I think that's going to work out really nicely for me. So anyways, Watchmen, yay, that's my review. And for my plug this week on Extra Hot Great Patreon feed, we have our third listener game time of this season. Thank you so much, everybody who has supported us. I will say this really quickly on that note, Extra Hot Great, again with this, and all your other independent-minded podcasts.
On Grief, On Belief, also mentioned, and Mastass.
We're all about to go through a bit of a traffic apocalypse because of new ways to measure podcasts brought down by the advertisers who advertise on podcasts. Conflict of interest? No. But basically, let's say for the sake of argument, your podcast was reporting 10,000 downloads. Soon, that's probably going to be more like 6,000 or 5,000 downloads because of the way they're now going to be putting in these new rules on how you measure. So if you were making $500 a month, you're probably going to be making $250 soon. So things like Patreon and direct support, tip jars, whatever the podcast you're listening to, is going to become a lot more important than ever for the people that depend on that to sort of keep the lights on. So, take a look at your playlist, see what shows you really enjoy, and, you know, consider dropping them a buck a month or whatever. It really helps in the end. So thank you to all our supporters.
Good note, Dave.
It is time for the canon. Our guest Karen is presenting this week. Take it away, Karen.
I am freaking thrilled that I get to do the Righteous Gemstones. And the episode that we're doing is episode 5 of the first season, and it's called Interlude. So I am wild about this show. I think it is extremely well done. Obviously, because I have a podcast about cults, and I've covered one of the cults that this show sort of draws from. I found it already instantly interesting, but I love Danny McBride and Jody Hill, and I would watch anything that they do. So for those people who don't know, The Righteous Gemstones is a show about a prosperity gospel family. They've lost their mom. All three of the kids are terrible people. I mean, Kelvin isn't so bad, but...
he's trying, but you're right. The other two are pure monsters.
A lot of prestige TV relies upon weird storytelling, meaning that they don't tell it in a linear fashion, or they, you know, they're telling things through flashbacks or, you know, jewel box stuff. And that doesn't always play, and it doesn't always work. This particular episode explains a lot of character motivation, but also gives you just really funny solitary moments that show you why you're watching this show. Let's go to the first clip, because it explains the genesis of what happens in this episode.
I'm having a baby.
Well, we can't cancel this tour, Amy Lee. I mean, what are you talking about? We have people counting on us.
Well, we're just going to have to disappoint them. Some things are just beyond our control.
What do you mean beyond our control? You're the one who splashed all that sperm all over her. I mean, this is a medical impossibility. I mean, how did this even happen? Amy Lee, you well into your 40s. Hadn't you ovulated all your eggs out by now?
You know what? You better stop that talk right now.
You need to stop.
So this particular episode shows us the reality of who Uncle Baby Billy is, good and bad. This particular scene is all about how Amy Lee finds out that against all odds, she is pregnant with Kelvin. She originally was set to do a tour with Uncle Baby Billy because she used to be in a duo with him, Amy Lee, Uncle Baby Billy, and they used to sing a number of different songs. We'll get to that in a second. And so he thinks that they're going to go on tour and he's going to cash in big time. And then she can't, and he has a bird on her. And this is so of the, like, Danny McBride style of writing, saying, like, shooting your sperm up into your woman. And haven't you ovulated all your eggs out by now? Which, like, they do some things in every show that they do. One is someone always has a temper tantrum, like throwing something like a child, like a binder, or like they, like, you know, they try to rip the binder in half and then they throw it. And like, that is always like hilarious business to me. And then there's always these like kind of extremely raw, extremely graphic insults that they do very well in very, very specific way. When Goggins was on Vice Principals, you saw this too. But that was the kind of stuff they made him say was more on the racial side. So your mileage may vary on whether you appreciate that. Let's go to the second clip where we get to know a little bit more about the kids.
All y'all care about is work.
You mean the thing that puts a roof over your head, food in your belly? What do you want us to do, Jesse? Just hope God sends down some chicken McDonald's from the heavens.
Judy, go upstairs, hon.
I like watching Jesse get in trouble. It makes my bird twitch.
Ew, Judy! Get out of here!
What the hell is a bird? Oh, is she talking about her privates?
It is my privates.
Get upstairs, Judy!
This is what, like 25 seconds? And it is so beautiful because you find out that Jesse does not want this kid. Judy doesn't want this kid either, but she is more concerned about watching Jesse get in trouble, which is like their dynamic down to a very fine point. The line chicken McDonald's the fucking funniest thing. And the look on John Goodman's face when he has to like have this realization that what a bird means is one of the funniest things that is on this particular episode. This scene is everybody at their most amped up, and it shows you how the family dynamic was, including a very important part. Up until this episode, we don't know much about the mother, and we have no idea what kind of a mother she was. And it's clear from watching her discipline her kids that she kind of just doesn't know what to do with them. Like, she kind of yells and kind of bickers, but she doesn't ever, like, discipline them, put them in a timeout, you know, when the son gets really hammered, which we're going to talk about. You know, she just kind of says, well, you know, you kind of learned your lesson. Like, there wasn't really any kind of blowback from that. And I think that's a really important part of this story is these kids didn't get to be these monsters without a sort of permissive mom or an absent mom on that level.
Yeah.
You don't harsh on her for it. Like, it's sort of a weird, you know what I mean? Like, you're not like, oh, she's a freaking terrible mom. Like, you're kind of like, okay, like, I get it. You got to pick your battles. So we flash forward to Judy has a birthday party, and you get to see all this horrible, horrible behavior. And I had to say that the girl that plays Judy as a child, she is like the fucking Meryl Streep of child actors. She embodies Judy. It's amazing.
Yeah.
She does an incredible job. The scene before this is about Uncle Baby Billy introducing Jesse to drinking beer. And so, as we have all done in our lives, Jesse drinks beer and he gets some gumption. And he decides to go confront his dad about this baby.
Hey, Eli Gemstone.
Jesse?
I really don't want to have another sibling. And if you all do have this kid, and if it ends up being a kid that's for real, like a real one, then guess what?
Have you been drinking?
Don't interrupt. Let me say, I will never be nice to this kid. And if you all do have this kid, I will make sure that its life is so dumb that every time y'all turn y'all's backs, I'll pee in its face. That's right, everybody. I'm Jesse Gemstone, Eli Gemstone's son. I'm about to throw up.
We should mention that he throws up exclusively into the barbecue on top of everybody's food.
And I'll just add, you couldn't have known that this is one of Sarah's big peeves, but I'll say, unlike every other show that has decided that vomiting is a good punchline, which is every show this year, it seems like, at least this one warned you that it's coming.
Right. Yeah, it did. I appreciated that. Could have done without it being left on the clip, though.
Yeah, I am surprised by that decision, too, Dave.
It was important.
Uh-huh.
So this is such a great scene to underlie Jesse's whole arc, which is that he's always been like this shit disturbing kid who's gotten away with stuff because his dad's a pastor. And when he tells his dad, like, don't interrupt me, that, like, I don't know about y'all, but growing up, if I had ever said that drunk, on drugs, whatever, to my parents, they would have absolutely flipped.
Yeah, I'd be dead.
So to me, I love this because everyone's just standing around horrified and this whole thing is happening basically in slow motion to everybody. And you see these great reaction shots. And then at the very end, they pan over to Uncle Baby Billy, who's just sitting there watching everything unfold. And that's such a moment because you see like all of the machinations that he goes through in order to destabilize the gemstones, which is something that comes up later on in the show. So now this scene, you're probably wondering why I picked this one, but there is an explanation.
How you feel, sweetheart?
Just fine.
No morning sickness or nothing. My wife, the tank.
Never call a pregnant woman a tank, Eli.
Unless I want to get blasted. Oh, I'm spinning gold this morning. I better save some for the broadcast.
You better be saving the good jokes for the broadcast. That one's not ready for prime time.
Good thing we're on in the morning.
So I chose this just because it is the only time in the entire series that we see Amy Lee and Eli interact as a husband and wife when there isn't really something at stake. And you get to see this sort of like interaction between a husband and wife. And you really get to see Eli as this total cornball dad who does not understand jokes. You get to see Amy Lee get amused by this and sort of be like, all right, you know. Yeah, I get it. And she appreciates it on a level that nobody else does. So much of the lore of the gemstones, every episode they're standing in front of this like eternal flame and this bus that does not look anything like Amy Lee and having conversations and referencing the mother. And the mother is such an overbearing presence in their lives. And then you see this very cute little moment. I just thought it really gives you a sense of what that relationship was like. So now we're going to go to the part that everybody in the world was talking about the day after it happened. It is decided at one point in this episode that Amy Lee and Uncle Baby Billy are going to do this tour, but they're going to make it a shortened tour and they're going to do it in 3 months. And so they're announcing it on their Gemstones program. This whole episode and this whole series is about Uncle Baby Billy trying to get back to a position where he once was with his sister. And this really underlines the whole thing because the decision to do the show goes back and forth and back and forth in this episode. And when you see this particular scene at the very beginning, they flip to Eli's face and he is absolutely fucking fuming at what's happening, but he is trying to remain calm. And it just shows you all of the dynamics in the family and also the most important thing about this show, which is what is your private life and what is your public life? And that is the essential conceit that the show tilts on all the time, which is what people are allowed to know about you versus what you show them. For the most important clip, which is the greatest song of 2019. It's a banger. It's your fall jam, I guess. Instead of your summer jam, your autumnal jam.
Yep.
It's the song Misbehavin'. We find out that this is the big hit that Amy Lee and Uncle Baby Billy had when they were kids.
We gonna sing and we gonna dance!
Said don't, but I said I'm gonna misbehaving.
Hide on a windowsill, swimming in the creek.
Catching crawdads and playing with a stick.
I wore lipstick
and I got comb shaving.
Just two little country kids outside misbehaving.
Teacher said don't, but I said it anyway, misbehaving.
Preacher said no, if you do, you're gonna pay misbehaving. The house with a pickle in my mouth.
Playing in the street, look at me outside waving.
Just two little kids out there misbehaving. We thought we was just messing around till we met that man in the thorny crown. It taught us that tricks and mischief leads to Satan. So from now on, there's no
tricks and no more misbehaving. No more tricks and no more misbehaving.
So a couple things about this. There's never going to be another show that's going to have a lyric about running through the house with a pickle in your mouth. So thank you. This is a beautiful scene because while they're doing this, they are so in sync, and you can tell that they've been doing this their whole lives. And it's really a beautiful performance put on by both of them. But there's some things that I want to point out about this. Up until now, we've heard that Amy Lee is a saint. She is this wonderful woman. She has, everything about her was absolutely glorious. She sings like shit. Like, her voice very is nasally. So, like, it's so high and nasal and doesn't have any, like, dimension. And I kind of love that they made sort of that choice that she didn't open up her mouth and sound like Aretha Franklin or, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't this, like, overdone thing. Like, she just sounds like a mom singing.
Well, she's played by a country star, which is even more funny that you have to be trained and know what you're doing to do it so badly.
Right. Yeah. Right. And also the clogging is pretty bad, too.
It's not great.
And that's what I love about this show is that everything is about what is being told to you and what you see. And I kind of love that. And that's why I sort of chose all of these different scenes knit together. And If anybody hasn't seen The Righteous Gemstones yet, I would highly recommend that you look it up. It's extremely funny. I'm really critical of comedy shows, especially comedy shows on HBO, because there's about a 50-50 return on that. But this show just delivered every single episode.
It's going to be interesting because when we did our initial Righteous Gemstones review, our panel was split 50-50. So I believe this episode was new to you, Sarah, from our watch. You didn't get all the way through, right?
Yes, it was.
So why don't you go first and tell us what you thought of 1-5?
This show is not for me, as we established in our previous conversation. There is something about McBrideyana that, like, I find it difficult to articulate, but first of all, some of this episode felt like just an excuse to put everyone in fugly sweaters and rent a bunch of Ben's SELs, which, that second thing, I'm never going to be mad. But, and it was, you know, nice to see some, like, character actors like my birthday mate, Emmett Walsh, showing up as the Grand Patriarch, and of course, Walton Goggins, who was really great in this role. I don't think he'd showed up by the time I bailed on this show, but there's just something very, like, I agree that the kid playing Judy, young Judy, is amazing, but there is, like, an unrelenting quality to the assholery in these shows sometimes that I'm like, I don't understand why this can't be leavened with something. With that said, like, was this an enjoyable 40 minutes? For me, not really. Like, barfing entirely aside, it felt too long. It felt too, it's just pushing too hard. Like, get off the gas for a second somewhere. Mm-hmm. We get it. Like, we get that. We get the concept. We get that they're nasty people. We get that the 80s were a fugly, hilarious time. Like, I was there. Got it. And yet, this is an amazing portrayal of what it is sometimes like between adult siblings.
Yep.
Who, like, this, how it is fraught, how it got fraught, why it stays fraught. And much of that is down to Goggins, but I think just as much of it is the writing. And this is enormously difficult for a lot of television to do. Siblings generally, like, I was always in my class that I taught last semester at Tisch, like, talking about these TV survey shows that we're watching, and I'm like, does anyone in these writers' rooms have a sibling? Has anyone met anyone who has a sibling? Like, why are these relationships always either creepy or, like, sitcomly adversarial, or, like, they literally never talk to each other? This really felt like a lived-in relationship between... Yeah. The two of them. Karen talked about that sort of lived in moment between the husband and wife. But I was most impressed by this, you know, brother sister push pull that, mm-hmm. like, there's a lot of love there, but there's also resentments that, like, there's just a family of origin brew of shit happening there. So, I'm not inclined to vote for an episode of this show because I don't really like it. But it has that one thing that I was extremely impressed by, so I don't know what I'm going to do. And that song really made me laugh, and the fact that that actor, like, her IMDb entry for acting is, like, 6 roles, and 2 of them are playing Dolly Parton's mom on, like, Coat of Many Colors movie spinoffs is fun for me. So, yeah, this was an interesting experience that it was like, I don't care for this show, but I have to acknowledge the skill in the creation and portrayal of this sibling relationship because it's uncommon.
It's so interesting to me to hear you say, like, that you connected to the sibling circus. I'm an only child. I didn't necessarily connect to it on the same level that you did. But the stuff that I connect to is the stuff that you hate about the show. Like, I have narcissist parents. So these people, watching these people blow up and yell at each other and have this, like, asshole party going on. That, like, I get that on, like, a deep level. So it's really interesting that we picked up on two sort of diametrically opposed parts of this show.
Which may be an argument for it being canonical, that it's like, yeah, you know, take your pick. But I don't know.
All right, well, I'll go next. Just a note about Jennifer Nettles. Again, as I said, she's a country star. She's not an actor. She's like half of the band Sugarland. And what I appreciated that watching it through the second time was the physicality that she brings to this role. Like, she, just the way she moves like an 80s lady. Like, mm-hmm. It's not just the glasses. It's not just the perm, although that's part of it.
Yeah.
But, like, she's, you know, she's tall and she kind of slouches. And she does this thing with her arms that, like, women don't do anymore, but they did back then, which is, like, they're bent at the elbow always, yes, and her wrists are just dangling. Like, she's walking around, she looks like Tootsie. Like, uh-huh. It's such an 80s thing. I don't know why, like, this was the style of how women moved in 1989, but it is. Like, that was true. And I also agree with Sarah about the sibling part. That was the part that struck me the most. And thank God I only have one sibling and she's wonderful. We have a great relationship. But all of the stuff with Amy Lee and baby Billy Rank felt so true to me. And the scene where she goes back to their house, like, mm-hmm, their childhood home, which is now like a famous sort of landmark, not just because 200 years of Freemans grew up there, but because, you know, they were famous and that's where they're from. Mm. And she has to, like, the reason that she agrees to do the tour is because he threatens to sell off parcels of land. And then after she agrees, she finds out, like, he just casually reveals that, oh, he already did sell off the land anyway. So that way, you know, he's betrayed her and she goes back on her word, obviously, because he sucks. But I agree with Sarah that the way that they talk to each other felt true. Like, it didn't feel like, as in so many cases where you see siblings in on a TV show, it seems like they're getting ready to fuck. Like, it's not the case, yeah, here. They, you know, they love each other, but they hate each other. And it's not just the sibling part, but it's also the former child star part where he's jealous of where she's gotten. And he later has a conversation with Eli where he's like, ever since you first walked in there, you only cared about her. Like, well, what did you think was going to happen? Like, he can't marry both of you. Like, did, yeah, you think that you were both going to be on this show? You know, like, this, you needed to figure out your own thing. She did and you didn't. And that's your fault. But that's like the animating resentment of, you know, the entire rest of his life going on to 30 years later, as we had seen in the previous episodes.
The moment in this episode that I thought highlighted that feeling was when he is being introduced to the crowd on the Gemstone show. And he's just like, it's me, silly baby, yeah, Billy. He's like, he doesn't, yeah, have a real persona of his, yeah, own.
And he just looks so sad, yeah, like from the nose up.
Yeah.
He's just like, I'm a whore and I hate myself. Mm. I should be clear that, you know, my brother and I did not have like a Pentecostal child star clogging concern. And
Sarah,
like,
your life's not over yet.
That's true. We could.
There's still time.
Yeah. Dave, text me. Let's set it up. My brother is great, but you know, shit happens between siblings that TV, for some reason, struggles with getting. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And even with my great relationship with my sister, like, there's still stuff from our past where it's like, you know, you recognize ways that you were treated differently. And like, it, you know, it's not on your mind all the time, but it's part of your relationship forever.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I also liked about this episode was getting to go back to before the compound times. We get another scene, which I thought was also nice, of Eli bringing Amy Lee to the mm-hmm. plot of land that he wants to buy. But at the point where we're seeing them, like, they still are living relatively modestly. Like, they have a nice house, but it's in a neighborhood. Like, they're clearly, all of their clothes are from JCPenney. Like, they're not fancy. And this is like the before time, before everything, you know, explodes for them financially, or else they're, you know, sitting on a big nut that they're not spending. So seeing them, you know, when they were still like, it was just a family business that was quite successful, as opposed to like a crazy empire, you know, that we had been seeing in the episodes before this. And of course, Misbehavin' is an all-timer. Like, when we watched this episode, I was, because we got screeners, I was like, in 4 weeks, everyone is going to lose their fucking minds, yeah, about the song. And they did. And, you know, I slightly resent having to hear it again because now it's going to be stuck in my head for like three more weeks after this while I'm trying to fall asleep. There's going to be Billy, you know, running through the house with a pickle in his mouth. Thanks. But yeah, this was the episode where I felt like the show really like locked in and I got a sense of what it was trying to do and that there was a heart under the meanness of the adult children. Like this is an interesting, and I think in terms of the season, it's an important episode for us to see as an origin story. And so my one knock on it was that I wish that Billy's son, who has some kind of intellectual disability, was not used as a punchline so much, because that seemed needlessly cruel. And like, we get it, he's a bad person, like Billy is, not the kid. We didn't need to see that on top of everything else. But I do think this is an excellent episode, and if I were going to pick an episode from the season to submit to the canon, it would be this one. So good choice, Karen. Dave.
Thanks. If you have like 2 seconds, I also just want to shout out, like, there's a scene at the beginning where they are in a restaurant that has a salad bar.
Yeah.
And that scene is so pitch point perfect to the era. Like, the bacon bits that are not actually made out of bacon. Like, it is pitch perfect. Cottage cheese as an option. People scooping out cottage. I mean, just perfect.
Yes. But even, like, the tablecloths and, like, all the crazy shit on the wall, like, all of that is like, oh, they're at Ponderosa or whatever that was.
Yeah, I mean, I got Ponderosa vibes, but I don't know, like, all of the places in America. But that's, like, if we were going to go to a place like that in the 80s, it would have been, like, either Ponderosa.
I loved Ponderosa so much.
Yeah.
I lived in Canada at the time. We would go across the border to eat at Ponderosa because there was nothing like it in Ontario at the time. So
we used to go over the border and go to Cracker Barrel. I'm not sure if that's much better.
Speaking about that salad bar scene, I really enjoyed the Breaking Bread song that they were playing
during that, which I
want to play a little snippet of it because if you haven't heard it, it'll get in your ear too.
Then Papa come home about when the sun went down. I said, what's happening, Papa? I said, Mom's just rolling up some dough and we're going to fry some bread tonight. Yeah. Some whole cake bread.
Yeah.
I know you know what that is.
Breaking bread with my mama, breaking bread with my papa, breaking bread. Breaking bread with my mama, breaking bread with my papa, breaking bread.
Yeah, it was a great addition to the soundtrack. That was the JBs, as in James Brown. There was James Brown backing. Backing ensemble.
Wow.
One of the other lines that I thought was really great in this episode, I'm just going to do a bunch of little things that nobody else has mentioned, is, I'll make sure its life is so dumb, the young Jesse screams to about the new arrival that's incoming. I'll make sure its life is so dumb. It's such a schoolyard thing to say that makes no sense, yet is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I just really enjoyed that. Now, when we first watched this, back when it first came out, we had screeners, and we'd watched this episode before they had put effects in. So we saw it with an old-looking John Goodman. So it was interesting to see an actual de-aged one and how they did it. Because I just assume when they did all that kind of stuff, like, he was walking around with dots and shit on his face, but he's not. They just do it algorithmically or something. Although some of the close-ups, he was a little shiny. It was a little overdone, but it was pretty good overall.
Yeah.
I thought the casting of Young McBride was pretty good. I felt like he got enough mannerisms correct that I knew where that character was going without being just small version of current day Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought they like just split the difference there nicely. And I kind of believed he was who he was at that age. The drinking scene felt like a pivotal moment in his life, obviously resulting in cooked vomit, which I think we all enjoyed, everybody on the panel. when this episode was over, I said to Tara, I said, I like Righteous Gemstones, but I also like this show inside of Righteous Gemstones. Like, if this was the show, if this was just like, you know, the Gemstones before they became righteous, I would enjoy this show too. The one part of Misbehaving that for some reason just I love is, I wash my hands to keep away from Satan is like the biblical bargain here. That's like the key to everlasting life, is just good personal hygiene. I kind of enjoy that message. And it really kind of takes me back to the days where my grandmother forced my mother to send me to Sunday school. And I was learning that kind of stuff. And I was like,
yeah, But it's so true of like the corny kids religious songs, like, you know, I remember when we saw the Simpsons episode where it was like, and if the devil doesn't like it, he can sit on a tack. And Dave was like, is that that? I told him that was a real song that we sang in Catholic school. And he was like stunned. But it was.
Yeah. It's a devil. It's OK if you wish ill on him. So yeah. It's a loophole in Catholicism.
The other part of Baby Billy I thought was very telling, is and stupid and fun, is that when he gets the bad news that his sister is pregnant and can no longer go on tour in the conference room at Gemstones Incorporated, he is leaving it at Huff. He takes his poster, then grabs like a palm tree that is like a 3-gallon palm tree from the floor in its fake brass pot. I was like, what? And he's just doing so like without expectation that anybody's going to say anything. And just little character moments like that I like. Sometimes you get these historical look episodes and they just don't click. But I thought this one added a lot to the mix. And as you said, we hadn't seen the mother before in a real way. So it was nice to get a sense of that character. I'm wondering if the bad singing is because she is doing a song that she sang as a kid and she's just trying to...
Oh, yeah. It's out of her register.
Do it that way. Like, do we hear her singing anything else that's not of that ilk? So maybe...
I don't think so.
If we do, like, you know, she sings something in a show in the future, it'll be more regular country kind of singing. So we'll see.
Well, but also, like, she only needed to be good as a kid singer. Like, she never needed to grow up and be an adult, trained singer.
Like, Karen, you were talking about real life operations that this is based off. What would those be, like, in name?
So we did an episode of our show on a church called Hillsong, and you might know that because that's the Justin Bieber church. Hillsong has this cool youth pastor named Carl Lentz, and if you look up a picture of Carl Lentz while I'm talking about this, you will see the resemblance between him and Kelvin Gemstone. And Hillsong is very much a profound money-making operation. They are based on Pentecostalism. They are all over the world. They started in Australia. And the whole thing is you get multiple encouragements during the sermons to give money, give as much as you can, and give more than you gave before. If you go on the Hillsong website, you can buy books, DVDs, jean jackets that have that are bejeweled. you can buy like tickets to their concerts, which are like $200. The sermons when they come to town are like huge rock events, and they hold them at stadiums and they hold them at really big arenas and things like that. So that is one of them that this is based on. There's also, you know, I mean, when you see in this flashback episode, I think that it's pretty obvious that they were drawing from like PTL, like the Jimmy Swaggart and the, Jim Baker,
yep.
Tammy Faye Baker.
Yeah.
They were trying to pull from that tradition. And that was a whole thing. Like that was like, if you had a TV on in the 80s, we did not have the same kind of, prestige TV available to us, and often there would be this terrible religious programming on Sunday afternoons.
700 Club all afternoon. Enjoy, kids. Yeah. Yay, cartoons are over. Sit down.
Yeah,
that's right.
I did enjoy this episode a lot. I am going to vote yes. Let's put this to the official vote with one last thought that I just remembered I wanted to mention, that the clown at the party only had one layer of white paint and it was really not doing the job was like the perfect creepy factor for that scene.
And when they show him from behind, he doesn't have anything on under his clown suit either.
Yeah.
All of the clown representations, though, were freaking creepy. They look like John Wayne Gacy paintings.
Clowns are creepy, inherently. All right. Sarah D. Bunting, you were on the fence before. You're mulling it over. What say you?
I my criteria include wanting to watch more, which I didn't. But I think this show does a lot of things right for other people. And the things that I talked about were really good. So I'm going to say yes.
All right. Tara Ariano.
I have a convert.
I'm going to vote first for a Mast Ass episode about misbehaving, and second, I'm going to vote yay.
And I'll say yay, too.
So, duly noted.
That means the Righteous Gemstones Season 1, Episode 5, Interlude. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hawkeye Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has the winner.
Yes, our winners are Grace and Frankie co-stars Jane Fonda and Sam Waterston, who were both arrested last Friday at a climate protest in D.C. This is the second consecutive week that Jane Fonda was arrested. The previous time, she was also arrested with her granddaughter and, like, tweeted about it and was like, her first arrest, not mine, because Jane Fonda is a badass. And if you want a reminder of this, go and watch the documentary about her on HBO, because she walks the walk and is great. And thank you for sticking up for the climate. Jane and Sam, keep it up.
Yeah.
And loser of the week?
Gabrielle Carteris.
Ooh.
Yeah. This story is ongoing. The Department of Labor is now investigating allegations of Carteris misconduct in the SAG-AFTRA elections. Her primary opponent at the time, Matthew Modine, was also investigated for improprietousness. surrounding his like direct mail, whatever. But the allegations now are that she got an in-kind campaign contribution from her employer on BH 90210, on which she played, of course, the president of Actors Guild of America.
Right.
And that she used inside information about SAG-AFTRA's Netflix deal to promote her candidacy. So the latest news on this is like a few days old, but we will keep you posted.
Speaking of troubling irregularities, do you know what time it is?
Oh, is it game time?
It's non-regulation game time.
Woo!
Because we just finished a season of Game Time, it is time for a non-regulation Game Time, which Dave gets to play.
Hooray!
I have written this one with apologies to friends. I'm calling it, it's all relative, or as Rachel says, it's all relative! As we all know, TV viewers get bored seeing the same old cast members week after week. The easiest way to make room for a guest star? Bring them in to play the relative of someone in your cast. This game tests your knowledge of the actors who guest starred on shows you know. And because I realize not everyone is A, good with names, or B, watches all the same shows that I do, there are many pointer-tunities built into each question. I'm going to give you the name of a series regular character and the name of the relative that the guest star played. So here's an example that I know Sarah knows. Logan Eccles' sister, Trina. So here's how it goes. If you can tell me the name of the show, you get 2 points. What's the show?
Veronica Mars.
Correct. For 2 points. If you can tell me the name of the guest star, that's 3 points.
Allison Hannigan.
Correct. But if you had not known, and if you needed a hint, I would tell you the name of the show, so you forgo those 2 points. If you still need a hint, I'll tell you the name of the series regular actor, which in this case would have been Jason Doering, after which naming the guest star will be worth 2 points. And if you still need a hint, I'll tell you another TV series where the guest star was a series regular. So in this case, I would say Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Gotcha.
And if you can get the guest star after that, you get a point. And since I know, again, not everyone knows names, I'll be scoring very loosely. If you know who the guest star is at any point before I name another show they were on, you can say, I don't know her name, but she was Willow on Buffy, and I will give it to you for 2 points. So let us throw it to Picky to see who goes first.
We will start with Sarah.
Okay, so let's go Sarah, then Dave, then Karen. Are you ready to play It's All Relative?
It's all relative.
I think so.
No.
Well, it's happening anyway. Here we go. Sarah.
Yes.
Elliot Stabler's mother, Bernie.
Bernie?
Yes.
I don't know. I need a hint.
Okay, well, first, what's the show?
The show is Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
Correct. So that's good for 2 points. I don't need to tell you Elliot Stabler's name. So the other show that this actor was on was Political Animals.
That doesn't help me. Do I have any other hints available?
No.
Okay, I don't know the answer.
I mean, other than I can tell you Chris Maloney, but you already knew that. So
yeah, I do.
For 2 points, the answer is Ellen Burstyn. So get 2 points for that, for naming the show.
Okay.
Okay, Dave.
Yeah.
Looking for Liz Lemon's brother, Mitch.
30 Rock and it's Andy Richter.
Correct. That's good for 5 points. Karen. We're looking for George Costanza's father, Frank.
Oh my God, it's Ben Stiller's dad. I don't remember what his first name is, though.
Also got to name the show.
Oh.
Yeah, what show is it?
Seinfeld, obviously.
That's good for 2 points.
And she explained it, like you said, is so-and-so's dad.
Yeah.
I'll accept that.
Yeah. I'll give you... No, that's okay. Yeah, the only other thing I was going to say was King of Queens, but that wouldn't help you. So, yes, I'll give you... So, 2 points for naming the show and 1 point for saying it's Jerry Stiller... Ben Stiller's dad, which is correct. Sarah, I am looking for Ben Covington's father, Andrew.
Oh, thanks, Picky. This is Felicity.
Correct for 2 points.
And that was played by Ritter.
Correct.
John Ritter.
Correct for 3 points. Get the full 5. Back to Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Carla Tortelli's daughter, Serafina.
Cheers.
Correct for 2 points.
I'm going to assume this is the only one I know of. Is Leah Remini.
Correct for 3 points. Nice. Good job.
Thank you.
Karen. Now I'm looking for Nadia Volvakov's mother, Lenora.
I have absolutely no idea. I'm going to need a clue.
Okay, the show is Russian Doll.
Oh, okay. I guess I didn't realize that was what her surname was. Sorry, give me the question again.
Who played Nadia's mother on Russian Doll?
Oh, okay. So it was,
And remember, you can say so-and-so from something else.
It was
else.
Chloe Sevigny, wasn't it?
That's correct for 3 points.
Okay. Nice. Good job.
There was a lot of hand shaking trying to come up with her name.
It's okay. Get back to Sarah. This is not Picky shining on you, but you might know it just from being in the culture. Rachel Green's sister, Jill.
That's Friends.
Correct for 2 points.
Wasn't her sister Reese Witherspoon?
That's correct for 3 points.
Thanks, culture and birthday mates.
Her other sister was played by Christina Applegate. She is not.
Okay, phew. Glad I didn't guess that one.
Okay, to Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Amy Santiago's father, Victor.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Jimmy Smith.
Correct for 2 points.
Jimmy Smith.
Correct for 3 points. Back to Karen. Looking for Jenna Maroney's mother, Verna.
Oh, okay. So the show is 30 Rock, obviously.
Correct for 2 points.
And it's Jane Hooks from Saturday Night.
It's Jan Hooks, but I'll give it to you for 3 points.
Jan Hooks, sorry.
She was just giving it an extra E. It was a bonus E.
All right, let's do a score break.
Okay, close game so far. Karen has 11, I have 12, and Dave is in the lead with 15.
Yay. Woo! Moving on, back to Sarah. I feel strongly that you're going to get this one. Steve Sanders' brother, Ryan.
Beverly Hills, 90210.
Correct for 2 points.
And his brother, Ryan, is played by Randy Spelling.
Correct for 3 points. Dave.
Yes.
Olivia Pope's mother, Maya Lewis.
Oh, boy. All right, A Scandal.
Correct for 2 points.
I know who this one is.
Oh, boy. It's somebody.
If you need a hint, I can tell you either who played Olivia Pope, although you know, or I can tell you another show that the guest star was
on. Yeah, give me another show.
News Radio.
Ah, shit. Candy Alexander.
Yeah.
I will give you 1 point for that.
All right, I'll take that 1 point. Thank you.
Karen, looking for Danny Castellano's brother, Richie.
Oh, my God. Okay, so that's the Mindy Project.
Correct, for 2 points.
Oh, my God. Do I remember enough about the Mindy Project to be able to answer the second part?
Danny's
no, I do
brother?
Not. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, here's a show that this actor was on.
Okay.
The Handmaid's Tale.
What? What? I'm so sorry. This is not helping me.
That's okay. You still get 2 points for knowing it was the Mindy Project. It's Max Minghella.
Okay.
Oh, that idiot.
Is that the overseer dude in the house?
What's that? Yeah, he was Nick.
Is that Nick or whatever? Yeah.
Okay. Purely a seminal role for him.
Literally. Okay, to Sarah. We're looking for Jake Peralta's father, Roger.
Jake Peralta's father, Roger. Well, this is Brooklyn Nine-Nine again.
Correct, for 2 points.
And his father, Roger, is obviously played by, I want to say Robert Guillaume, but I don't want to give a wrong answer. So can I have a hint, please?
Sure. The actor who played Roger was also a series regular on The West Wing.
Shit. I don't know. Martin Sheen?
Bradley Whitford.
Oh. Speaking of The Handmaid's Tale.
All right. To Karen. No, to Dave.
Yes.
We're looking for John J.D., Dorian's brother, Dan.
Oh, shit. Okay, so that's Scrubs.
Correct, for 2 points.
And that actor's name is... Oh, shit. I can only remember his name on the show. It's Ed Kavanaugh.
I'll give you 1 point. He is from Ed. It's Tom Kavanaugh.
Tom Kavanaugh. All right. Well, you know, it's plus. I mixed. It was a blended answer.
You got a point.
Both Mike and Tom eat snacks.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that. Okay, back to Karen. We're looking for Kimmy Schmidt's mother, Lorianne.
Oh, okay. So this is the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and that
That's
is
correct for 2 points.
Lisa Kudrow.
Correct for 3 points.
Nice.
To Sarah. Raina James' father, Lamar Wyatt.
Wow. That's Nashville.
Correct for 2 points.
And her father was played by Powers Booth?
Yes, for 3 points. Good job.
I'm exhausted.
This might be another one where Picky has smiled on David T. Cole. Looking for Rebecca Howe's sister, Susan.
Oh, shit. Okay, Cheers.
Correct, for 2 points.
Sister. They were competitive.
Do you want to know another show where she was a series regular?
I'm going to need a show. Give me a show, I guess.
Desperate Housewives.
Oh, shit, right. Yeah, and also Melrose Place, right?
Yeah, I'll give you 1 point.
Marissa
for that.
Cross?
For triangulating it, it's Marcia Cross.
Marcia Cross, not Marissa Cross. All right.
Okay. To Karen, looking for Jess Day's sister, Abby.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. I have no idea.
Okay. The show is New Girl.
Oh, yeah. I have never. Like, I saw the Prince episode of that, and that's it. I have no idea.
All right, you're going to give me 1 more point. You could get it for 1 point with this hint. Abby, the actor who played her, also was a series regular on Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, Busy Phillips?
No. The other one is Linda Cardellini.
Linda Cardellini?
Yep. All right, let's do a score break.
Okay, it's getting tense. Karen has, I can't count these hash marks, sorry, 18. And then Dave and I both have 24.
Ooh. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Here we go. Back to Sarah. We are looking for Dave Rose's father, Big Dave.
Dave Rose's father, Big Dave. I will need to know what show this is.
The show is Happy Endings.
Who the fuck played Big Dave? I watched that entire show. I need another hint.
For 1 point, if you get it off this, Better Call Saul.
Bob Odenkirk?
No.
Completely
good guess.
Forgot
it's
that
Michael McKean.
Oh, right. Oh. Shit. Okay.
My second guess is going to be Ermentrout, so, you know.
Oh, well, he played Adam Scott's dad on Parks and Recreation. Not in this game. Right. To Dave.
Yeah.
We're looking for Elise Keaton's brother, Ned.
Elise Keaton's brother, Ned.
Yep.
Like, at least keep from family ties?
Correct. That's for,
okay,
good for 2 points.
Okay, I'm not going to need a clue. No idea.
Ned was also a series regular on a show called Bosom Buddies.
Oh, Peter Scolari?
No, the other one.
Really?
Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks? Really? I had no idea he did other stuff. Okay, all right, fine.
Don't you remember Alex coming to have a maraschino cherry in the miracle? He was an alcoholic.
I barely watched that show. I know, like, only, like, the very special episodes history of that. That's pretty much it.
Oh, God. Yeah, which he was in.
Oh, was he?
He's an alcoholic, but okay.
All right, to Karen. Looking for Kenneth Parcell's mother, Pearline.
Okay, well, that's obviously 30 Rock.
Good for 2 points.
His mother. Who played his mother? I can't picture her.
Oh, yeah. I know who the stepfather
was. I can give you a hint.
Okay, let's have a hint.
She's also on Schitt's Creek.
Oh, God, that's not going to help me. I haven't seen a fucking episode of that.
You're a terrible Canadian, Karen.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Canadian TV site.
It's Catherine O'Hara.
Oh, okay.
All right, back to Sarah D. Bunting. We are looking for Eleanor Shellstrop's mother, Donna.
This is The Good Place.
Correct for 2 points.
Is this Busy Phillips?
Do you want the hint for what other show this Donna was on?
Sure.
Popular.
Oh, right. Leslie Grossman. Do
good
I still
for
get
one
it,
point.
Though? Because I guessed wrong.
No, you still get a point.
Oh, okay.
All right, to Dave. Mm-hmm. Looking for who played Ray Holt's sister, Debbie.
Oh, boy. All right, Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Correct for 2 points.
Ray Holt's sister, Debbie. I can't picture it. I'm going to need the clue.
Debbie is also a series regular on Claws.
Oh, really? How come I don't remember this? Was it Niecy Nash?
That's good for 1 point, yes.
Oh, why do I have no memory of that? That's troubling.
I don't know.
Where did that memory go?
I know. Where is that?
Because that should have stuck in my head. Okay, worrying. Okay.
Class, all right, I'm glad this came up earlier because I think, Karen, you're going to get this one. This one we're looking for. Who played Mary Cherry's mother, Cherry? Cherry.
I'm not going to get this. I'm sorry.
Do you know what show it is, Mary Cherry?
No.
Okay, it's from Popular.
I've never seen that show either.
All right. What if I told you Cherry Cherry played a series regular on Designing Women?
Oh, Jean Smart?
No, that would have been good casting too, though. It is, in fact, Delta Burke. All right, let's do one last score
Popular,
break, and then everyone else
it's
do
so
their
good.
Last question.
I'm sorry, Tara. Did you need another score break?
Yes.
Okay. Karen has 20. I have 27. David T. Cole has 29.
Whoa.
How many questions left?
One.
Oh.
So, yeah, you really got to fuck this chicken for us to have a chance.
All right. Here we go. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
We're looking for who played Noah Hunter's sister, Renee.
Noah Hunter had a sister, Renee. Oh, Renault. Okay, this is Beverly Hills 90210.
It sure is, for 2 points. Mm.
So I can guess and not be penalized. His sister, Renee.
Mm-hmm.
We
covered this on the podcast.
At a time. I mean, it had to do with Noah. You expect me to remember that bullshit? I don't know.
I mean,
Roberta
maybe?
Guillaume. I don't know. I need a hint.
Okay. Renee is also played by someone who is a series regular on the show Unreal.
What? Oh, my God. I completely forgot about this. Sherry Appleby?
That's good for 1 point.
Oh, my God. It was the hardest fought point ever.
All right, Dave, here's your last question.
So, wait, Sarah's got one more point than me. Hang on. What? Sarah's got one more point than me.
Yes, I am ahead by 1 point currently, but you haven't played yet, so it doesn't really count.
Okay. We'll see. Does Dave know this person's name? Dave, we're looking for who plays Jed Bartlett's daughter, Zoe.
That's West Wing Elizabeth Moss.
That's good for 5 points.
Guess so.
I love democracy.
All right, Karen, your last question.
I get to put everybody out of their misery.
Okay. Who played Dee Dee Blanchard's mother who did not get a name on the show?
Oh, my God. Okay, well, the show is The Act.
That's good for 2 points.
Oh, my God. Who played the mother? I only saw this, like, a couple months ago. Oh, my God. I don't remember. Can I have a clue?
Yes. This actress is also a series regular on Sneaky Pete.
I have no fucking clue.
A show that exists.
I've watched the entire thing, so you wouldn't have to.
I have seen a notification on Amazon about that show.
Is Sneaky Pete a different show than Peaky Blinders?
Yep.
Okay. Yes.
If you say so.
All also right. A different show
We're
from
gonna
Chance.
We're going to stop this now. Sarah?
Miss Margot Martindale.
That is correct. Oh, so right. What are our final scores?
Our final scores are Karen with 22, myself with 30, and David T. Cole with 34 beautiful points.
Yay.
Good job, Dave.
Thank you.
So we also have a tiebreaker. Well, let's play it for Steel Meals so Dave, you can sit out.
Well,
Here we go.
Wait, hang on. How do I sit out?
If he gets it, he can give it to someone.
Yeah, I can give it to somebody.
Or nobody. Oh, you want to just have it and throw it away?
Who knows?
That's fine.
I want to control it, though. Okay.
Okay, fine. That's right. Fine. You can play.
All right. Thank you.
Here we go.
Wait, what are we, what's the answer? Show what? The actor?
You were looking, actor.
Okay.
Yell out the actor.
Got it.
Who played Homer Simpson's brother, Herb Powell?
Danny DeVito.
Dave is correct.
Yay. And so he controls the steam mill. Great.
Dave!
Thank you. Dave. Thank you, Tara, for making a game for me to play.
You're welcome.
I love the game dives. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We applied our Kremlinology skills to the new HBO miniseries Catherine the Great before going around the dial with stops at Living with Yourself, Modern Love, The Politician, Buzz, Survivor, Ken Burns Country Music, and Watchmen. Karen sang the praises of the Righteous Gemstones flashback episode interlude for the canon, and it was good. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and me, David T. Cole, was the winner of this week's non-regulation game time, in which I now own a steel mill somehow. Remember...
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, thinking about evil ways to use a steel mill, and on behalf of Tara Ariano...
Lipstick.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Broshai.
And Karen Geyer.
Running through the house with a pickle in my mouth.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Chicken McDonald's.